a wonderful way to start the year, is it? It seems a very sad chapter, and I guess that it is. And you may be thinking, well, I wish that at the start of this new year he'd chosen something different, stopped the series and done something else. And yet, again, as this morning, as I reflected on this passage and its suitability for today, let's realize what is happening in this section in Genesis. At the end of chapter 22 that we read together, you'll find about all these children that have been born. In chapter 23, then, the bulk of what we read about a death. And then in chapter 4, we read about a wedding. So in this little section of Genesis, what we have really is all the major events of life coming together that we might reflect on them and the different aspects of those great times in our families. And it seems to me that actually in many ways that's often what we do, isn't it, at the end or the beginning of a year. We look back or we look forward to those great times that hit our families, some very joyful, some very sorrowful. And therefore, I think at this time of New Year, as the Lord has providentially given us this chapter, it's, I trust, will be good for us to reflect on this and to reflect on these great times that we have in our own experiences. Of course, having said that, Abram was no ordinary man, was he? At one level, he was a man just like us. But I'm sure as we've read through the story of Abraham, it's seemed to many of us, well, here is a real man of God. And maybe many of us have read the story and think, well, I'd love to be like Abram. In some ways, there's no excuse for us not to be like Abram. He worshipped the same God whom we worship. We have many advantages that Abram did not have. And yet he was this great man of God. And in particular, what Abraham had were these promises of God that had been given to him over these many, many years. You remember he had the promise of Isaac, his son, which we've seen come to fruition over recent chapters. But he had this greater promise as well about this great nation which would come from him. And it seems to me as we've gone through this section that Abraham has relied on those promises of God in a very real and clear way. And as I've read through chapter 23, it seems to me that that's exactly what Abram is doing here as well. And so what I want to do this evening, therefore, is to look at the promises of God and how the promises of God help us in our darkest days. How the promises of God help us in our darkest days. That's the theme for this evening. There's three things that I want to say to you. Here's the first one. The promises of God don't prevent the darkest days. The promises of God don't prevent the darkest days. You'll see it's very obvious from this chapter that this was a dark time for Abraham, wasn't it? Sarah, we read about her right at the very beginning of the chapter in verse 1. She lived 127 years. 127 years. We don't know exactly when Abraham and Sarah were married. But we have to know, don't we, that they were married a very long time. It had been 62 years since she and Abram had left Ur together, so they were married at least that long, probably much longer, given their age. They'd been married a very long time. And they were, I think it's fair to say, I'm sorry if you don't like the expression, but they were soulmates. In many ways, she'd been that way on his journey from Ur through to Canaan, down into Egypt. Do you remember that story, all the trouble that she had down there, back up then to the land of Canaan? She was there at all these great moments of Abraham's life when God gave Abram the promises. Sarah was there or very nearby. She was there when Abram defeated those kings, when Lot had been captured. She was there when Abraham met Melchizedek, the king of Salem. She was there when the covenant of circumcision was made. She was there when she and Abram had those new names given to them by God. She was there when Abram interceded for Sodom. She was there at the time when Abraham went to sacrifice and to offer Isaac there on the altar. She was there for all those times at Abram's side. She was also there and saw Abram's failures, didn't she? That failure down in Egypt when he passed her off as his sister. That time when he repeated the error, certainly should have known better. She saw many failures of her own that Abram knew. Abram knew the way that she had treated Hagar. The way that she didn't believe, at least at first, the promise that God had given concerning Isaac. They'd experienced all that together, both good and bad. And then in her old age, Abram and Sarah together had that wonderful, unexpected joy of the arrival of Isaac and a sharing of that time together too. But now they've been married for, 75 years, 80 years, 100 years? They've been married all that time and now she's dead. The passage begins, doesn't it, in verse 2, so Sarah died. It's very stark, it's very clear. The passage ends that we read together that he buried his wife. And in all of this, in between, we have all these references. Can you see all these references to burying and dead? They're there for us time after time. Verse 3, he stood up from before his dead. Verse 4, that I may bury my dead. Verse 6, bury your dead. Again, verse 6 at the end, bury your dead. Verse 8, bury my dead. Verse 9, a burial place. Can you see the real emphasis that's being driven here? This is, the writer really wants us to understand this, that the promises of God don't prevent the darkest days. This was a dark day for Abraham. What does he do? How does he respond? Well, he responds in exactly the appropriate way. Can you see it at the end of verse 2? Abram came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. He came to mourn and to weep. You see, as he knew the death of his loved one, maybe he started to reflect on all that he had enjoyed with her and all, therefore, that he had now lost. There are some people, of course, seems strange, but often Christians who seem to suggest that we shouldn't mourn when others die, that somehow that suggests that we don't really have enough faith in the promises of God. But of course, the biblical picture is very different. When somebody dies, their loved ones mourn. That's how it should be. We do submit to the Lord's will. But in submitting to the Lord's will, we know that sometimes the Lord's will brings pain to us. You see, if there was ever somebody in the Bible who was a godly man, Abraham's got to be near the top of the list. And yet when his wife died, Abram mourned. He didn't simply say, well, such is the will of God, and quietly get on as if nothing had happened. But he mourned and he grieved for his wife. It's interesting as we go through Genesis, this is the first time that we read of Abram crying. There were many things that had perhaps saddened him before. Maybe his own sin, maybe the destruction of Sodom, maybe the loss of Lot, as he no doubt thought it. But he didn't weep, we recorded, in those situations, but here he does. Why is it that people weep in such situations? Well, surely the answer, and this ties into where we're heading in our evening messages in 1 Corinthians 15, surely the answer is that death is our great enemy, is it not? That here is something that cannot be reversed in this life, that Sarah will not come back. Yes, Abram has this hope that one day he will go to her, but she will never come back to him. You see, mourning is the right response in death. Not a showy, necessarily an outward mourning, not necessarily a ritualistic mourning that is not felt, but something that is deep, however it is shown, something that is real, a real loss and a real sadness. And especially where the relationship is a deep one, as it was between Abram and Sarah, then a weeping and a mourning is a natural and right expression of grief. It shows the loss. It shows that it's keenly felt. It shows that death is an enemy. It shows us the reality of the sin that has brought this sad punishment upon the human race. After September the 11th, it was the Queen who said that grief is the price we pay for love. She was right. Jesus said once, didn't he, that in this world the poor will always be with you. He could equally have said, the grieving will always be with you, because in this world we will all know grief. You see, the promises of God don't prevent the darkest of days. But here's the second point for you this evening. The promises of God don't prevent the darkest days, but the promises of God help us shine in the darkest days. The promises of God help us shine in the darkest days. You see, Abram, as we read in verse 2, came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. But it's also true to say that Abram didn't go to pieces, did he? He didn't carry on his mourning indefinitely. He didn't continue in this and never be able to deal with the everyday situations of life. He handled his mourning in the right and proper way. And actually, what he does, therefore, he's got this immediate job that he needs to do. He needs to make sure that his wife, even in her death, is cared for properly. And we have this wonderful illustration and narrative of what happens. He's securing a grave for her. And he goes to speak to the Hittites, and we have this very elaborate and careful exchange, and it gives us a real insight as to what life would have been like in Abram's day, as we have this in great detail. Because what Abram does is he goes in verse 3, he stands before the sons of Heth, and he says to them, I'm a foreigner and a visitor. In other words, what he's saying is, I don't own any property in this land. I'm just passing through. And because I don't own any property, I'm not able to bury my wife on my own land, because I have no land. Therefore, verse 4, will you give me property for a burial place among you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight? And this is where Abram really shines. He shines in his darkest days. You see, as we look at the way in which Abram deals with these Hittites who are around him, and the way in which he responds to the situation in which he finds himself, he really shines as a man of God. And the promises of God help us to shine in the darkest days. We'll see as we come towards the end of the sermon how much Abram is relying on those promises. But for the time being, let's focus on the way in which Abram shines. You see, he's obviously known already to these people that he comes to, because in verse 6 we read that they say to him, you're a mighty prince among us. Some of you have got the translation, prince of God among us. And that's because the Hebrew word for mighty is Elohim, which is very often translated as God. You are a mighty prince, or a prince of God among us. You see the difference between verse 6 and verse 4? In verse 4, I'm a foreigner and a visitor. In verse 6, you're a mighty prince. Well, isn't Abram shining for us already? You see, he's got a very humble opinion of himself, hasn't he? I'm a foreigner and a visitor. I have nothing to my name. But actually, the people who's around, who see him in his grief, who've watched him over time, they realize that he's nothing of the sort. He's their Lord. He's a mighty prince, or a prince of God. They see something different about this man. He's someone who's shining. Well, are they right to see something different in him? Let's continue. He says in verse 8, well, if it is your wish that I may bury my dead, then will you meet with Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me? It seems that Abram has some contact with the sons of Heth. They know him, but maybe Ephron, the son of Zohar, doesn't know him. But Ephron does know the sons of Heth, so they're going to act as some kind of an intermediary. And what he wants from Ephron, verse 9, is the cave of Machpelah. He's had his eye, it seems, on this particular cave. That would be an ideal place in which to bury his wife. You'll understand, don't you, that in the wilderness, in the deserts, that a cave, a rocky, cold place is a very suitable place for burial, much more so than burial in the ground. So he asks for this cave, but he's clear, he's shining again, end of verse 9. Let him give it to me at the full price as property for a burial place among you. It would have been very easy for Abram to, in his grief and his sadness, well, what better time to count on the favour of others? But Abram doesn't do that. He doesn't want others to put himself in the debt of others. He wants to do things properly. He's shining, even in this situation. He wants to pay the full price. He says that right up front. Those of you who ever haggle, you never start off your haggling or you start off your discussion with, I want to pay the full price. Some of you have bought property, maybe a house. For most of us, that's what that property will look like. You never say at the beginning, I want to pay the full price. We never do it, do we? We always think, well, maybe the house costs £100,000 or so. Well, I'm willing to pay £95,000, we might think. We don't even offer £95,000, do we? We'll start off at £85,000, and hopefully, maybe they'll meet us somewhere, and we might end up paying less than we can afford. That's what we do, isn't it? That's the custom of our time. It was a custom of Abram's time, too. But he doesn't want to do that here. He wants to do things properly. He's shining. Because what he's doing here is buying a resting place for his wife. He doesn't want to shortchange her. He doesn't, if I can put it like that, wants to do a bargain and get the cheapest deal he can. He wants to do what's right and proper. He wants the people to know how much he values this and how much he wants it to be done right. And he says, therefore, I will pay the full price. He's shining in all this. And then in verse 10, we find that Ephron then comes and meets with Abram, and they come at the entrance to the gate. Some of you will know that in ancient times, that's where you did your business. It's the equivalent of the town square, maybe, in a century ago in the UK. But in these days, it was the gate at which you would go to do business. That's where everyone gathered. And the sons of Heth are there to act as witnesses in the transaction. And then we have this wonderful little vignette, verse 11. No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field and the cave that is in it. Now you might think, well, what a generous chap this Ephron is. All Abram has asked for is the cave. But actually, Ephron's going to give him the field as well. But remember what Ephron is doing here. Because what Abram says is, I'll pay you the full price. So maybe the cave is worth 100 shekels. So that's what Ephron will get if he sells him the cave. He'll get 100 shekels. But what Ephron is doing says, look, I'll throw in the field as well. And what's he going to get now? Well, he's not going to get 100 shekels because Abram's promised to pay the full price. He's going to get 400 shekels, we'll see. That seems to many commentators a vastly inflated price. But that's what Ephron does. Ephron is wheeling and dealing, even if Abram is not. And he says, therefore, in verse 15, it's worth 400 shekels. But here, Ephron, typical wheeler-dealer. Well, what's that between friends, he says. Well, 400 shekels of silver would be an awful lot to you and to me, probably way out of our price range. Even for a rich man like Abraham, it's certainly not something to be sniffed at. And Abram shines again. He simply weighs out the silver for Ephron. You see, it would have been easy for Abram to say at this point, look, I know I said at the beginning that I'd pay full price, but they listen, there are limits, you know. I said I'd say pay full price for the cave. I never said anything about the field. But Abram keeps his promise, even goes beyond his promise. He shines. And even in this, he gives him the 400 shekels. He weighs it out. Can you see how careful the language is? It's weighed out. And it's named in the hearing of the sons of Heth. There are the witnesses. 400 shekels of silver. Currency of the merchants. Make sure. Sometimes maybe one person from one particular area would have a slightly different measure of what a shekel was to the ones that others would have. And there'd be arguments as to exactly the value. Abram doesn't... not going to have any of those problems. It's the currency of the merchants that he uses. And so the field then is bought by Abram in this way. You see, it may seem a small thing. You may think, well, hang on a second here. This man's wife has died. Surely there's more important things going on in the passage than merely the fact that Abram shines in these business dealings, we might call them. Yes, there are more important things going on in the passage. This is one point out of three, but this is still an important point. The writer goes through in some detail. He didn't need to do this. He could have explained this to us in a line or two, but the scripture dwells on this. Why? Well, I think because he wants us to understand that Abram is shining, because the promises of God are helping Abram to shine even in the darkest situation. People often point the fingers at believers, don't they, at Christians? Well, they're not living up to what they say they believe. Here Abraham, in all these ways, in the way that he handles in his grief, in the way that he conducts himself, in the way that he treats others, he's being a godly man, is he not? And that's surely what the world expects of those who profess the name of God. He's doing things right. And if Abram can do that in his darkest hour, then surely we can do it in our normal everyday life. You see, the promises of God help us to shine. The promises of God help us to shine. How could Abram be so composed? In all his grief, do you not expect him to be a bit irritable, to snap at people, to not to deal with people? And do you not expect that? Well, maybe we do. So why could Abram be so composed even in this situation? Well, let me give you two possibilities by way of application. I think the first reason that we can give is that Abram has spent years developing a godly character. He's had his trials, he's had his tribulations. At times he hasn't lived a perfect life by any means. But he has spent years developing this godly character. And what we find in our lives, if we invest into our lives that godly character, that when times get particularly tough and when days get very dark, we can draw on all those reserves. And we find that when we're not quite in control of our own feelings and our own circumstances and things feel out of control, as maybe they did a little bit to Abraham here, yet that godly character has taken such a root in our lives that it shines through even in our darkest days. And there's a warning there to us, isn't there? Those of us who are not in darkest days. Are we preparing ourselves for those days? Are we developing godly character? You know what we read in the New Testament, don't we? Let me turn to it very quickly. That we're told that let me just find the verse. We're told that in the book of James that blessed is the man who endures temptation. When he's been approved, he'll receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. We're told that when each one is tempted, he's drawn away by his own desires. He's enticed. When desire is conceived, it brings birth to sin. Sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. We can see the way in which bad character comes over time, can't it? And brings its inevitable consequences in the time, which eventually is death. Well, you know, godly character works in just the same way. That if we develop a godly character, that builds too. And it builds and it builds. And we find then in our very difficult and dark situations that our character is ready and the foundation holds. And we need to be careful then to build up these things in the good times. One of the criticisms of the Labour government, I'm not going to comment on whether the criticism was justified or not, but one of the criticisms is that when the sun was shining, they didn't mend the roof. Thinking about the economy, when the economy was doing well, they didn't build up plenty of reserves. So that when the dark financial days struck, there wasn't that great foundation left for them to draw on. And it's like that with our character too. We need to develop godly character as Abram did, so that when the dark days come, we're ready. That's one reason, perhaps, why Abram was able to shine even in these dark days. But here's a second reason, that in his grief was tempered by hope. In his grief was tempered by hope. And therefore, even though Abram wept and even though Abram mourned, he did not mourn as one who had no hope. But in his grief, his hope was still there, that great solid rock that could not be moved. And that leads us very much into our third point then. We know that the promises of God help us shine in our dark days, even though the promises of God don't prevent the darkest days. Here's the third point. The promises of God are most precious in our darkest days. The promises of God are most precious in our darkest days. You see, God's promises didn't just help Abram to be able to deal in a right way with all the business and the other things that were going on. It didn't just enable him to treat well the people who were around him, although it helped him to do that. But the promises of God went much deeper in Abram's life, didn't they? The promises of God helped him in a far more fundamental way than merely in the ways in which we've touched on already. It didn't just help Abram in this immediate crisis of where do I bury my wife? But it helped him in those great age-old eternal questions of where is the meaning and purpose in all this? Where is the hope in my grieving? The promises of God reach to that level. And we find many of you can testify by personal experiences that the promises of God are most precious in our darkest days. A few days ago, I was reading Spurgeon. Spurgeon is always wonderfully quotable. I think there's probably every sermon that's been preached you could find put a very good quote from Spurgeon in it. But here is a wonderful thing that Spurgeon says about the dark days. This is what he says. He says, "I bear witness that the worst days I have ever had have turned out to be my best days. And when God has seemed most cruel to me, he has then been most kind. If there is anything in this world for which I would bless him more than for anything else, it is for pain and affliction. I am sure that in these things, the richest, tenderest love has been manifested to me. Our Father's wagons rumble most heavily when they are bringing us the richest freight of the bullion of his grace. Love letters from heaven are often sent in black-edged envelopes. The cloud that is black with horror is big with mercy. Fear not the storm. It brings healing in its wings, and when Jesus is with you in the vessel, the tempest only hastens the ship to its desired haven." Spurgeon knew what it was to suffer pain and affliction, but he knew what it was to lean on God. He knew that the promises of God are most precious in our darkest days. So how did the promises of God help Abram in his great grief? And how can the promises of God help us in our dark days? Well, we need to understand what Abram was doing as he bought Ephron's field to help us answer that question. You see, when Abram bought Ephron's field, it wasn't only to bury Sarah, but he was also expressing his confidence in God's promises. Do you remember that what God had promised to Abram was this land that he would dwell in and his descendants would dwell in? So when Abram thought about where he would bury Sarah, he obviously therefore, because he trusted in God's promises, he wanted to bury her there in the land that God had given to him. He wanted to, as it were, claim God's promise. He wanted everybody to know, God has promised me this land, so this is where I will leave my life, my wife, in the place that God has promised me. He was expressing and testifying to his faith and confidence in God. You see, but at this stage of Abram's life, he didn't own the land, it didn't belong to him. The Hittites lived there, these sons of Heth lived there, others owned the land. He was merely a wanderer, passing through, a foreigner, a sojourner. But God had said, right back in chapter 12, "I will give you this land to your offspring." Do you remember that later on that the Lord then said, "Look, lift up your eyes, look to the north and the south, look to the east and the west. All that you can see I'll give to you and your offspring forever. They'll be like the dust of the earth. If anyone would count them, that's how many offspring you're going to have. Walk through the land. Look at it. This is what I'm going to give you." Do you remember? Well, Abram remembered. Abram remembered that God had given him this land. And then God listed it later, didn't he, in chapter 15, the land of the Kenites and the Kezizzites and the Kadmonites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and all those other ites. God had given it to him. So when Sarah died, then Abram, as he buried her, it was his sign of faith that he believed that God would fulfill his promises, that God would do what he said. So by faith, Abram buried Sarah in this cave in Hebron. I'm stealing my own thunder for a few weeks' time, but when we get to chapter 25, we'll find that by faith Isaac buried Abram in the same cave. When we get to chapter 49 of Genesis, we find that Jacob buried his father Isaac at Hebron too. And we know that when Jacob then was in Egypt, do you remember what Jacob himself asked his sons in chapter 49? Bury me in Hebron. And Jacob's sons did exactly that, even though Jacob died miles from Hebron. They took his remains there, and in chapter 50 they buried him there too. So, 430 years later, Moses took Joseph's bones out of Egypt, and he carried those up and he buried them there too. Joshua buried them there too. Moses, of course, was buried just before the entrance to the promised land, in that same plot of land. Well, why did Abram then purchase this land? Well, he purchased it to bury his wife. But why did he not already have land? Well, Abram knew that the promise of God was for his descendants. He knew that a better promise had been given to him, better than land. And that's what he told us back in verse 4. Do you remember? I'm a foreigner and a visitor among you. You see, as Abram bought this land, he didn't, as it were, buy it for himself to live in, did he? Because he was a foreigner and a visitor. But he bought it for Sarah. It was for her. Abraham didn't buy other land for himself. He didn't want to live near her to tend the grave. No, he was a visitor and a foreigner. And what the writer wants us to understand, what Moses wants us to understand, is that here in chapter 23, the only person who was truly at home, the only person who was truly at rest, was not Abram, but Sarah. That's what Abram's purchase represented. This was his great reminder to others, and probably predominantly to himself, that whilst he was still a stranger, whilst he was still a foreigner, his wife had arrived safely home. That's what this cave represents. Let me read to you some verses from Hebrews chapter 11 as we bring this message to a conclusion. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 13, we read this. The earlier part of the chapter has spoken about Abel and Enoch, and it's just spoken about Abram and Sarah. And then in verse 13 of Hebrews 11, on page 1069, we read that these all died in faith. Abram, Sarah, and those who went before, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind the country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You see, that's what Abram knew. He knew that he was a foreigner. He knew that he was a pilgrim going through this land. He knew that he had a better hope. He knew that he had a better home. He didn't need a land for himself, because he knew it was only the dead who were truly at rest. He knew that it was his wife who was truly at home, and not he himself. And it's that great hope, it was that great promise that sustained him and kept him. It was that promise that reminded him that the promises of God are most precious in our darkest days. And what was true of Abram, you see, ought to be true of each of us as well. If we go to the book of Ephesians and chapter 2, we read that once we were without Christ, we were aliens, away from the commonwealth of Israel, strangers from the covenant of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. He himself is our peace, we're told. He has made both, that's Jew and Gentile, one, broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity that is the law, that he might reconcile, verse 16. So verse 19, now therefore, you're no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, including people like Abram, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. Do you see the remarkable blessings that we have that the writer of Hebrews 11 and then Paul speaks of in Ephesians 2? As Abram went through his life, he had to say, I'm a pilgrim, I'm a foreigner, I'm a stranger. Well, it's true of us in this life. But at the very same time, we're able to say, I'm no longer an alien, I'm no longer a foreigner. Because I once was an alien from God, but now in Jesus Christ, who was once far off, have been brought near by the blood of Christ. Because he himself is my peace. I once was without Christ, but now I have Christ. And therefore we can say, I am no longer a stranger. I am no longer a foreigner. But I'm a fellow citizen with the saints and members of the household of God. That's the great glory. You see, Abram didn't know that to the way that we know it. He died not yet having seen that hope. The hope was still afar off. But for us, the hope is here. The hope is real. And the hope is near. And the hope that Abram had, that one day he would go to the city of God, that's our hope too. We lack nothing that Abram had, but we have much that he did not. We have the glorious reality of being no longer a stranger, but part of a great community of God's people in every nation of the land, in every period of history, going right back to Abram's day and before. We're one with him because we're all one in Christ. But we still have the great hope that Abram have, of the city that is to come, of the mansion in glory prepared for those who love the Lord Jesus Christ, whose sins have been forgiven. You see, the promises of God are most precious in our darkest days. And no matter what we face, and no matter what has already come, that promise of God to keep us, to say sustain us, and to bring us safely home, that promise will never be withdrawn. It will never be taken away. It is ours. It's ours to cling to. It's ours to glory in. It's ours to hold dear. Pray that it will protect us and keep us in our darkest days.